As you may not be aware, this is the 50th anniversary of the Stonewall riots. You may not have heard that, but just in case, I need to tell you, this is a big year and a big anniversary, and as luck would have it, we, the Gay and Lesbian Review, are celebrating our 25th anniversary. We published our first issue in 1994, and that was the 25th year of Stonewall. So we kind of share this this anniversary, although we are half as old. So it's kind of interesting, and it led to sort of an inevitable conclusion that the only logical thing to do would be to publish a book that commemorated both anniversaries at the same time. So I went back and selected some of the best articles that are in some way related to Stonewall, either the riots themselves or the period leading up to the riots or the period right after the riots. There's also a section in the book on kind of the long-term legacy of Stonewall. And we ended up with some 30 articles or so, which I would say are some of the best pieces that we've published over our 25-year history. So, with that said, I'm going to just read two pages, which some of the first paragraph will kind of repeat what I just said. Sorry about that. And give you a little bit more of background on the book itself. The year was 1994. It was the 25th anniversary of the Stonewall riots, and, as luck would have it, the year in which a new magazine called the Harvard Gay and Lesbian Review was publishing its first issue. That was winter of 94. The quote, Harvard was dropped in 2000, worldwide added, like I just said. But other than that, the GNLR has had an uninterrupted run of 136 issues over the past quarter century. The fact that our first year coincided with Stonewall's 25th proved a happy coincidence, if only because it gave us something important to talk about that year. But it also joined our fate with that of the founding event of the modern LGBT movement. This book commemorates our own 25th birthday with a collection of Stonewall-related articles selected from the issues published to date. I've chosen the title, In Search of Stonewall, for this collection because it seems to me that the events of 1969 remain elusive in at least two ways. First, there is the journalistic question of just what happened on the night of June 28th. Who started the riot, what happened next, who threw the first brick and all that stuff. Second, because Stonewall, kind of in scare quotes, exists as a symbol of the LGBT movement quite apart from the historic event itself, the search is always on for the meaning of Stonewall as it was first conceived and as it has evolved over the years. If nothing else, it is a marker in historical time with a clearly defined before and after. But to imply that Stonewall interrupted the flow of history single-handedly resetting the LGBT calendar is to pile a lot of responsibility onto a single event or era. Still, something happened, and it happened quite rapidly and even magically after the riots. So in this sense, the search for Stonewall can also be a desire to reconnect with the overpowering energy and excitement of this period. The sequence of events following the riots, the founding of new gay organizations, new publications, the first Pride Parade in 1970, June of 70, and so on, are indeed a breathtaking slice of history. The question of why Stonewall became the symbolic birthplace of the modern LGBT movement has been raised, sometimes with considerable passion, by many people who point out that the West Coast is where the movement really began way back in the 1950s, complete with organizations and magazines and even riots long before 1969. The fact that it took New York City to spark a national movement undoubtedly has more to do with that city's sheer size, I should say this city's sheer size, and dominance of the news media, especially at that time, than to a lack of passion or organizing savvy on the West Coast. Also, let's face it, Stonewall is a damn good name for a popular struggle. What if the riots had happened at Uncle Charlie's? What distinguished the early movement as it fanned out from New York was a new emphasis on, quote, coming out about one's sexuality to family, friends, and anyone else who would listen. California groups like the Mattachine and the Daughters of Bilitis were secretive organizations whose members largely hid their identities. The concept of coming out as a personal imperative was clearly a prerequisite for a mass movement, which is by definition a public undertaking. Feminists and leftists at that time exhorted people to see the personal as the political. LGBT people had no choice. The decision to come out as gay, especially when homosexuality was illegal, was an intrinsically political action. The Stonewall riots have been compared to the storming of the Bastille in 1789. It's a fair comparison, however much they differed in size and scale. Both were collective acts of resistance against an oppressive establishment. Both demonstrated the power of numbers and the possibility of fighting back. And both gave rise to a movement for which this founding event became a rallying cry. For the LGBT rights movement, having a symbolic starting point has been especially important. Unlike the civil rights movement, which was assembled and sustained by charismatic leaders like Martin Luther King Jr., the LGBT movement never really produced a central figure to personify its goals. Stonewall provided not only a founding event, but also an anniversary to celebrate each June. So now, each of us is going to take about 10 minutes to either talk or read from the book. And I think we'll start with Michael Denneny, who is the second person to my left, which I think Michael's piece kind of is a good segue from what I just read. Michael is co-founder of Christopher Street magazine back in 1976. He worked as a senior editor and published numerous gay books at St. Martin's Press starting in the 1980s. He set up a whole imprint there. Maybe he might talk about that, but was a major, major force in gay publishing when it was in its infancy and came out with some of the most important early LGBT books starting in the 1980s. Don't know the exact year. He currently works as an independent editor in New York City. Michael Denneny.
As we celebrate the 50th anniversary of the Stonewall riots, much is being written about that now mythical event, which is generally taken as the birth of the contemporary gay and lesbian rights movement. Much of what I have read strikes me as wrong-headed, especially the revisionist attempts by the currently politically correct to downplay the role of white males in that event. 25 years ago, I hadn't realized this must have been almost your first issue.
Indeed it was.
25 years ago, as we were approaching the first major anniversary of the Stonewall riots, I read a manuscript proposal generated by a PBS television series on gay rights that asserted that, quote, middle-class white men, end quote, had, quote, stolen, unquote, their word, Stonewall as an event appropriating to themselves an action generated by lesbians, transvestites, and people of color. The authors offered no evidence for this statement, just blandly asserting this revision of history with the same smug and self-righteous certainty that Stalin's encyclopedists must have felt as they dutifully revised their history books decade after decade. In retrospect, all these squabbles to claim credit are not only petty, but beside the point, except when they interfere with the attempt to ascertain historically what actually happened. They are beside the point because they misunderstand how an event like Stonewall actually comes to interact with history, becomes a part of history, or not. Stonewall was not the first time gay people had confronted the police, nor the first time we had stood up for ourselves. John Preston once told me about a remarkably similar event that took place at a gay bar in Chicago a year or so earlier. The police were harassing the bar owners and made the patrons walk a long gauntlet of cops while being photographed entering and leaving the place. For the people involved, this confrontation was as harrowing and as heroic as Stonewall, but it had no echo across the country and is now almost forgotten. There had also been a similar confrontation in LA and in San Francisco, for that matter. So what made Stonewall different? Immanuel Kant wrote of the French Revolution that it was not so much the event itself that was going to change the world as the quality of attention paid to it by its spectators, by those observers across Europe who watched the unfolding events in Paris and knew that something momentous had happened. When the revolutionaries stormed the Bastille, they actually ended up freeing precisely 7 individuals, including, by the way, the Marquis de Sade, an event whose immediate political impact was virtually nil. But the idea of storming the Bastille made a huge impact on the imagination of observers all across Europe. It was what the spectators made of the events of the French Revolution that would change history, not what the rioters in Paris had done. In other words, it is when an event is raised to the level of an idea that it has the power to alter history through changing the consciousness of people. I would argue that something similar is the case with Stonewall. It was definitely not the first sign of the emerging gay revolt. A year and a half before Stonewall, a couple of guys had started The Advocate, the first national gay newspaper in Los Angeles. And at about the same time, Troy Perry had established the first of the Metropolitan Community Churches, today the largest gay organization in the world. Clearly, something was afoot with gay people even before the events at Stonewall. What was missing was any sense of possibility, any alternative to the oppression gay people faced daily wherever they looked. To get a sense of the mental oppression gays and lesbians labored under, this lack of possibility that was so spiritually suffocating, one might look at Mott Crowley's play, The Boys in the Band, a much maligned work that precisely delineates the pre-revolutionary emotional situation that would lead to Stonewall. The play essentially is about 8 gay men and 1 straight. In essence, the gay guys, who are extremely unhappy and bitchy, start the evening beating up on each other and progress till their anger is directed at the straight man. What is amazing in this play is that none of the gay characters has any sense of possibility, of any way out of the trap of gay life as it was then led. Although they are clearly angry to the point of fury, the idea of gay liberation is the furthest thing from their minds. As someone who remembers the years before Stonewall, I can testify that the very concept of gay liberation would have struck most of us, even those of us who were intensely political, as absurd. Being homosexual was seen as a psychological situation, maybe a medical situation, but certainly not a political matter. Luckily for everyone, the women's movement came along and got us to consider the notion that the personal was political, a major step forward. Then what was needed was a crystallizing moment in the 4 continuous nights of rioting that the raid on Stonewall provoked, offered that moment. The news of the riots flashed through the underground gay world in America like a thunderclap, a loud noise that woke you up, and acted as a catalyst which precipitated out of this turbulent emotional mix a sudden burst of organizing and theorizing, giving rise to new gay consciousness. What was decisive was not the event itself, but how people responded, the immediate, spontaneous, an utterly decentralized flurry of organizing, leafleting, and pamphleteering that resulted, and that was so well documented in Don Teal's 1972 book, The Gay Militants. It was this response, and perhaps above all, the late Craig Rodwell's determination to commemorate Stonewall next June with the world's first gay pride march, that made Stonewall the shot heard round the world. The event had become an idea. The idea that gay people would fight back, would stand up for their rights, and ideas can change the world.
That works better out there. Why don't we go now to Amy Hoffman, who is sitting to Michael's left. Amy Hoffman is the author of the novel The Off-Season and the memoirs Hospital Time, An Army of Ex-Lovers, : My Life at the Gay Community News. In other words, that's one book. And another book, Lies About My Family. A writing instructor at Emerson College, she was editor-in-chief of the Women's Review of Books for 14 years. So, to Amy Hoffman.
Thank you. And thanks for inviting me to be on the panel. My essay that I published in Gay and Lesbian Review actually started as a talk I was asked to give about why LGBTQ activists should learn about history. And as I started writing about it, I was thinking about silence, its meanings, and its consequences. Recovering or reframing history, creating a people's history, has been important for all identity-based social movements, but it's been particularly revelatory for the LGBTQ movement. Michel Foucault, quoted in Eve Sedgwick's Epistemology of the Closet, says, "There is no binary division to be made between what one says and what one does not say. We must try to determine the different ways of not saying things. There is not one, but many silences, and they are an integral part of the strategies that underlie and permeate discourses." Well, that's Foucault. I think what he meant is that silence itself communicates specific, complex social messages. Several years ago, this is when I wrote the essay, when the reporter Anderson Cooper came out in a statement to the blogger Andrew Sullivan, the curious thing about Cooper's statement was that it was already widely known that he is gay. The media eagerly covered Cooper's statement while paradoxically also maintaining that it was not much of a story, which the New York Times business section, for one, hailed as a sign of today's acceptance of LGBTQ people. A few days after Cooper's non-revelation in a Times op-ed, the gay author Daniel Mendelsohn noted that this supposed acceptance enabled Cooper to deny, in effect, being closeted. "I have always been very open and honest about this part of my life with my friends, my family, and my colleagues," Cooper wrote. "In a perfect world, I don't think it's anyone's business." This is really complicated. If it's nobody's business, then why the need to be open and honest? And how out must one be to be truly out? If Cooper wasn't out to his media audience, was he indeed being open and honest? So what is the meaning of this particular silence about something that, as Leonard Cohen sang, everybody knows? As any kid worrying about whether and how to and when to come out to their family can tell you, there's a big difference between everyone knowing you're gay and telling them you're gay. A gay cousin of mine begged me when he came out to me, sort of unnecessarily, not to tell his grandmother, my great aunt. She, like everyone else in the family, knew he was gay. But to tell her he was gay would have been to risk their loving relationship. So the problem wasn't gayness. It was breaking the silence, acknowledging it, forcing it into the cultural discourse. Do tell. In my essay, I went on about the personal and political evolution of breaking this silence. But for now, I'll just stop here so we can continue thinking about Stonewall, about breaking silences, about what we want to say when we break silences, and how we create languages to talk about ourselves. Thanks.
Let me now introduce Carla Jay, who is on the far left, possibly in more ways than one. But I don't know, though. I think we're all pretty far. I'm guessing. Carla Jay is Professor Emerita of English, Women's and Gender Studies, and Queer Studies at Pace University, or as I always say, Pace University in New York. She's the author of Tales of the Lavender Menace, which came out in 1999, and a memoir, which is a memoir about creating the modern LGBT movement in the wake of the Stonewall Uprising. I should mention, by the way, there's an exhibit like right outside these doors on the history of the LGBT movement, and there's a little section on the Lavender Menace, and Carla may well be pictured there. I don't know what she looked like, 40 years ago or whatever it was, but she might very well be among the women who are pictured. In any case, I would recommend the exhibit out there. My partner Stephen and I checked it out earlier today, and it's really quite nicely done. So if you have a chance to come back when the museum is open, I would recommend it. Anyway, here's Carla Jay.
Thank you. I'm actually in the nightlife exhibit talking about Cookie's Bar. And I'm really hoping Cookie is no longer alive. And talking about dancing in after hours bars with my friend Marcia P. Johnson, because we used to go out after dances and go to after hours bars. Today, I'm going to talk just a little bit about my piece in the book, which is about the first gay march, but in Los Angeles in 1970. We forget that there were two marches. Now, in Los Angeles, there was a particular problem in that the police chief, whose name was Ed Davis, said to the public that they couldn't, to the marchers, to the Gay Liberation Front in LA, that they could not have this march because, his words, it would, quote, discommode the public. I always love that quote. And if he let gay people march, he would have to let thieves and burglars march too. And so he said no, and we'd have to have $1 million in a bail fund, and we'd have to put up all of this money for this and that. Finally, the ACLU came to our rescue, and he was forced to give us a permit. So at 6 p.m. on the last Sunday in June of 1970, we gathered at the corner of McCadden Place and Hollywood Boulevard, because it was 6 p.m. It was, L.A., we didn't want to miss a good beach day. And we walked a mile because no one in L.A. had ever walked more than a mile. No one I knew. Very few had walked that far. And it was a very Hollywood parade. Now, in New York, up to 5,000 people marched. In Los Angeles, a guy was there with a counter, and there were 1,169 people. He may have missed a few, including, I just... Actually, today, a press association called me because I'd mentioned the floats. I said, this was Hollywood, we had to have floats. But we had wanted to have a flatbed with a closet on it, and all kinds of people, LGBT people, coming out of this closet over and over and over again. But because of the injunction against the march, we couldn't get it together. So at the last minute, some guy got together a flatbed truck with a huge fake jar of Vaseline on top. And there's only one photo of it that exists. And finally, my spouse, Karen, turned it up today, and it turned out to be by this guy, Mother Boats. I don't know if you ever heard of him. Did you hear of Mother Boats and his sidekick, John Jefferson Fuck Poland, whom I met in that march? I hadn't thought of this in 50 years. How soon you try to forget these things. Because I remember Jeff was walking in the march wearing only a pair of women's underpants. That's how I met him. And it was hard to forget him because he later asked me to marry him. So that, there were two reasons it was hard to forget this guy. And the thought of myself being Mrs. Fuck Poland, that was also hard to forget, I have to tell you. If I ever wanted to change my name, that was not my first choice. Anyway, we finished the march, and then we went to a bar, which was handily called Satan's. And when we were there, we found out that Troy Perry had returned to the start of the march, and he had sat down with two of his female parishioners at McCadden and Hollywood to fast until civil rights were gained. I mean, Troy would be he would have been the world's thinnest man had he lived to see the day. But Troy being Troy, and you know, I love Troy, but he was very fastidious. So he first put down a clean cloth and then he had a sit-in. And he was arrested. And what was strange about this was, this being LA, the people just drove right by him and didn't even notice there were three people sitting in the middle of the crossroads. It was just really amazing. So at the dance, Morris Kite, who is the head of the LA GLF, came in, told us that Troy was arrested, which created a lot of anger because no one liked it when the music stopped. And he told us what had happened, and there was a big argument, as always happened in a gay liberation front anywhere in the world, and we didn't know what to do. So half of us wanted to go to the police station at Wilcox Avenue, and the other half of us wanted to continue dancing. The argument was ended when one of the dancers shook up a bottle of beer, poured it over Morris Kite and the microphone, and short-circuited the entire conversation. But the next day, Troy and the two women did get out of jail, and we followed it up with a sit-in, which I was part of, at the Federal Building for 10 days of fasting and sitting. It was very boring. We waited for something to happen, but you know how sit-ins go. You expect to be arrested any minute, but nothing actually really happens, except you get your fortune told over and over again by someone with a deck of tarot cards. And 10 days later, we gave it up, and it took many years for us to get our rights. But it was a very interesting march, and there was also one in San Francisco. So we shouldn't forget that the first year, there were many marches, not just the one in New York, which I also worked on to get the one here to take place. Thank you.
Thanks, Carla. So our final speaker is to my left, Timothy Stewart Winter, and he is the author of Queer Clout, Chicago and the Rise of Gay Politics. He is an associate professor of history at Rutgers University in Newark.
Thanks so much. I'm really honored to be here. I am almost never in the position of being the token representative of San Francisco, because my book is about Chicago. But this essay, which I think is, and I teach in New Jersey, Chicago, by the way, home of the first gay rights organization in the US, founded in 1924, and one of four cities, I think, with marches in 1970. This is, I think, one of the best things I've ever written, thanks to Richard's editing. And it's the fruit of a dissertation project that I researched and then abandoned on San Francisco's Castro District. It's fairly long, so I'll stop at a certain point, but how the Castro became the Castro. San Francisco's Castro District was the first big city neighborhood in the US where openly gay people elected one of their own to represent them in City Hall. Harvey Milk, the man who was elected in this capacity in 1977, soon became nationally prominent as the leading spokesperson for gay and lesbian rights in a bitterly fought contest over a 1978 statewide ballot measure that would have banned homosexuals from serving as school teachers. The Castro's mythical status was cemented by the assassination of Milk and Mayor George Moscone less than a year into Milk's first term, and by the so-called White Knight riots that followed the lenient sentence given to Dan White, the former police officer who murdered them. Today, the Castro's terrain of hilly asphalt is a site of pilgrimage, its bars and restaurants home to a lucrative tourist trade and a gay nightlife scene. But how did the Castro come to be the world's most famous gay neighborhood in the first place? most accounts focus on two processes. First, gay artists, hippies, and radicals migrated to central San Francisco during and after the 1967 Summer of Love in the Haight-Ashbury district, which is nearly adjacent to the Castro. These adventuresome urban pioneers are said to have discovered the hidden charm of the picturesque Victorian houses that had suffered long years of neglect under a regimen of asbestos, tar paper, and aluminum siding perpetrated by clueless heterosexuals. The second narrative centers on the mobilization of gay activists, including Milk, who demanded and won the right to be open about their homosexuality and obtain political representation. Both narratives throw the spotlight on the people who built the Castro district rather than on the larger social conditions in which they operated. In point of fact, the gayification of the Castro was strongly affected by the processes of urban change and political development that were taking place at this time. Between 1849 and 1915, real estate developers built nearly 50,000 Victorian houses in San Francisco. And I talk a little bit about that. Jumping ahead, the area around the Castro Street commercial strip was just far enough from San Francisco's northeastern core that its Victorian houses escaped destruction in the 1906 earthquake and fire. This area, long known as Eureka Valley, or sometimes by the name of Most Holy Redeemer Parish, was populated by white ethnics, mostly Catholics, from the 1920s when the Twin Peaks Tunnel brought increased traffic to the area to the early 70s. Nestled in a valley, unencumbered by tenements or high-rises, Eureka Valley in the 40s and 50s seemed to its residents to be almost self-contained. It was home to small business owners, church officials, school teachers, professionals, club organizers, and above all, skilled, unionized workers in the waterfront industries of one of America's busiest ports. The city's gay and lesbian community institutions, its bars, were elsewhere in the city's dense northeastern quadrant near the waterfront. The Castro Theater, built in 1924, was only one of several movie palaces in the neighborhood, but it was the sole one to survive the invention of television. Having sifted through the historical record on the Castro, I concluded that the dense concentration of storefront taverns along the two or three blocks of Castro Street just below Market was at least as crucial a factor in its gayification as the Victorian houses. Bars had long been central cultural institutions for white men in America's immigrant centers, and San Francisco, known as the wettest in the West, resisted federal and state enforcement of prohibition. The elderly men and women that filmmaker Peter Stein interviewed for his documentary, The Castro, which was made by KQED Television in 1997, recall that the two-block commercial strip on Castro Street alone had 9 bars in the post-World War II period. The consumption of alcohol on a Saturday night per capita was tremendous, one man recalled. Liquor licenses were difficult and expensive to obtain, and when commercial properties changed hands in San Francisco, the licenses frequently remained in place, constituting a neglected feature of the Castro's built environment. In 1950, men made up the majority of Eureka Valley's employed adults, and among them, the largest fraction, 46%, worked in traditionally blue-collar occupations on the city's waterfront or in the skilled trades. 30% of employed men and 66% of employed women worked in what the census called non-managerial clerical sales or service positions. But the neighborhood's economic foundation was beginning to deteriorate. Blue-collar jobs, homes, and families all began to leave San Francisco, replaced by white-collar office jobs in the newly built downtown skyscrapers. As shipping was automated and moved across the bay to Oakland, so too did the waterfront jobs that Eureka Valley men had long held. In the 1950s, the city's banking employment nearly doubled, but maritime employment dropped by a quarter. The white population dropped 13%, while the black population increased 43%. National trends hurt San Francisco's traditional industries, including timber, oil, and food processing, and companies also sought to escape the city's powerful unions. By the 1960s, white blue-collar family men were increasingly moving to the suburbs, and the city's adult population was growing younger, more white-collar, and more professional. Spending several nights a week drinking in taverns was not this crowd's idea of a good time. The decline of the male-dominated family wage economy of Eureka Valley was becoming untenable, and women and gay men were challenging long-standing norms. Above all, unlike their straight brothers, San Francisco's growing gay minority patronized the bars faithfully. In 1969, gay liberationist Carl Whitman declared that San Francisco is a refugee camp for homosexuals, and this would only become more true in the following decade. And I go on to talk about the gayification as a transition from one masculine tavern subculture to another. And I talk about two neighborhood newspapers in the early 1970s, one called the Noe Eureka Weekly Shopper, whose complete run from June 1971 to March 1972 is preserved in the San Francisco Public Library. And in it, you can glimpse the lives of older, longtime residents drawn together by bingo nights, parish musicals, and clubs sharing Irish, Italian, or Scandinavian descent. In the summer of 1971, articles debating the opening of new and unusual stores expressed the feeling of seeing the city or the neighborhood seemingly taken over by outsiders. In contrast, the Castro Village Other, available in the GLBT Historical Society, shows in the following summer of 1972, there's one man advertising for a roommate who's into biodegradable detergents and into the spiritual trip. Another wrote, young and interesting Nordic American male, age 27, seeks friends, male or female, for tripping and fun. By August, a gay columnist wrote in California Scene that around Castro Street, local residents have gotten uptight. The police are beginning to drop by the gay bars, and roving gangs of youths, possibly taking their cue from their parents, are beating up gay guys on their way home at night. And I'll stop there. Thanks so much.
Thank you. We'll open the floor to questions in a moment, but I thought I would pitch a question to the panelists that they can all choose to answer in any way they choose, or not answer if they don't find it interesting. So I think with these four readings and discussions, we've covered a range of topics and eras before, during, and after Stonewall. But I thought it would be interesting, since this is, after all, the 50th anniversary, and here we are in New York City, it would be interesting to kind of bring things up to date, maybe talk about the upcoming parade itself, and a certain controversy about the parade. There will actually be not one parade, as you may know, but two parades. One of them, the parade that you're all familiar with and I'm sure you know and love, we're calling it the mainstream parade, which I think last year or in recent years it's been taking 6 hours to pass by, and I can only imagine what the Stonewall 50 will do to the sheer length of the parade. And yet, that's not all. There's more. There's going to be another parade, which is going to be launched by a group called Reclaim Pride. And they're sort of coming at this from, perhaps you could say further left, from a position that views the mainstream parade as just that, as mainstream, as kind of assimilationist. And they are, the Reclaim Pride people are very critical of the fact that the parade, the main one, will have corporate floats and corporate sponsorship, and it will have an atmosphere of celebration as opposed to politics. So as a matter of fact, in this issue of the GNLR, there are at least two articles that talk about that, and they talk about kind of changes in the LGBT movement over the years, which have sort of gotten us to where we are. They're actually, two of the articles kind of defend or talk about the Reclaim Pride parade and the claims made by those who are launching it, which have to do with inclusiveness and, you know, the corporatization, or somebody calls it the Disneyfication of the parade. One of them in particular, Robert Baez in this issue, does talk about what he sees as more of a long-term division in the LGBT movement. And he even talks about the fact that it can be traced back perhaps to the very beginning after Stonewall. You probably all know, and I think someone talked about the Gay Liberation Front, or the GLF, which was founded almost immediately after the Stonewall riots. And very soon, I think this was in July of 69, but by December, the GLF had split, and so now something called the Gay Activists Alliance, or the GAA, broke off. And they broke off because they wanted to be essentially a single issue organization, whereas the GLF was trying to change the world. They had this kind of overall vision of gay liberation that was going to be sexual liberation for everyone, not just for LGBT people, but for all of society. And they were involved in women's issues and anti-war issues and all kinds of things. And the argument from the GAA was, no, we really just have to focus on gay rights. Back then it was called just gay rights. That was going to be the focus from now on, at least as far as the GAA was concerned. And I have to say, you know, that model seems to be the one that won out. When the GLR came into existence in 1994, the debate was raging, I think, between these two fundamental forces, and there was kind of a shift, because I think that the liberation model had still prevailed through the AIDS era of the 80s. But by the 1990s, there was, one might say, a more conservative or perhaps a more assimilationist agenda, which is maybe represented by the Human Rights Campaign and other organizations, maybe the Task Force or Lambda Legal, which were very much focused on just the one issue of gay rights and adopted a somewhat different model, which was more like a civil rights model or an identity politics model, similar to that of the women's movement or the African American movement. We are just going to go for sort of minimal legal equality. That's what this struggle is going to be all about. And that's the model that I think has basically won out. And I think, personally, it's done pretty well. I mean, we have same-sex marriage and service in the military, and we've made a great deal of progress, I think, under that aegis to some extent. And yet, there still is, I think, a legitimate argument that something has been lost in the process. And so here we are now, 50 years later, or if you prefer, 25 years later, and we have two parades. And it seems that this kind of fundamental division persists in the movement, and maybe it will always be with us, and maybe it's just kind of the nature of the beast that we are always going to have this. But I wonder what it means, or if you folks have an idea, what can be said about the fact that there will be two parades on June 30th instead of one parade. Anybody want to field that? Amy.
I'll say a few things. First of all, it's not the first time there have been two parades. There were two parades, the ones I know of, at the 10th anniversary, the 25th anniversary, and now the 50th anniversary. Oh, yeah. And another thing I was going to say, because I enjoyed so much hearing Carla talk about the Los Angeles parade, is that in Boston, maybe typical of Boston where I'm from, we had a march, and we were very adamant about calling it a march, a demonstration. It was, our first march was in 1971, and it had four targets: the church, the bars, the police, and the state house. And the marchers went to symbols of each of those and protested. And only after a while did it evolve into a parade where representatives of those institutions actually march with us. So it's something to think about. I do sort of agree with you that throughout the history of the modern LGBTQ movement, there have been two main tendencies. One that frames the movement's issues somewhat narrowly, that works on legislative change, that insists that queer people's needs and aspirations are just like everyone else's, and a liberation perspective that frames the movement broadly as interconnected with other movements for social justice. that works on cultural and institutional change that elevates the unique contributions and culture of LGBTQ people. I don't think the two tendencies are mutually exclusive. I mean, people, you know, rights people, liberationists join political campaigns, people who are gay rights people, as you're defining it, Richard, march in demonstrations. But as our slogan used to say, Stonewall was a riot. And we want to, the liberationist folks want us to remember that. I think every generation kind of has its own Stonewall. Michael was talking about different ways that have that people have seen it. One of the things that's inspiring to me is that I guess our current Stonewall is led by gender rebels who challenge binaries. I feel like binaries of all sorts need to be questioned and overturned. Binaries like virgin and whore, and white and person of color, and immigrant and alien. I mean, let's look at all of those kinds of oppositions. Our movement is about love and respect for people's humanity and the power of that.
Yeah. I've been very much caught up in this because as a member of the Gay Liberation Front, I'm one of the Grand Marshals. So we applied for that position long before there was a split. And however, that being said, of course, half of the GLF will march with Reclaim and half will go with HOP. Our goal in applying to be Grand Marshal was to get what was starting to be the forgotten history of the Gay Liberation Front and radical lesbians, which did the famous Lavender Menace action, back out into the public eye. I went to many exhibits that would start with Stonewall or before Stonewall, and suddenly they'd be with the Gay Activists Alliance, and we were trying to get our history back out there. After we were accepted as Grand Marshals, Reclaim split. And there's no animosity, actually. We, those of us who are going with HOP, Reclaim, we're all getting on very well. The only sad thing is that they're at the same time. I don't call any of them parades, by the way. To me, it's a march. Macy's is a parade. And it is very sad that they're at the same time. There are actually four marches in New York. There's a trans march on Friday night, and there's always the Dyke March on Saturday night. And for me, the Dyke March is my favorite march. It's no permits, no floats. Come as you are, go as you are. And to me, that's the way of the future. And the only downside of two marches is we're in a very delicate historical position. My heart is really with Reclaim, but to have a division at the dog wants to speak, to have a division at this point in history, when we have these forces in the administration against us, to me, I find very troubling. You know, we really need to be united, whether we believe in legislative change or, as I do, in more radical social cultural change. We really need, I think, to present a united front against the current political forces, and that's my only concern about it. Otherwise, you know, the more the merrier.
I want to add a couple thoughts. Chicago had two marches for several years in the 70s because lesbians chose to have a separate march from gay men. And there's also a Dyke March and a, starting in the 1990s, there was a Windy City Black Pride, which in a lot of ways, I think more closely resembles the sort of do-it-yourself ethos of Pride in the 70s. At least that's my impression. And actually there were, for a couple of years, dueling Black Pride events in Chicago. I think in terms of what changed, one of the sort of things that I always come back to is the decline of routine police harassment of predominantly white gay establishments, right, which happened between 1965 and 1985 in every city, every US city, mostly between 60 and 80. Chicago had a big raid in 1985. But the process kind of, to me, that was another kind of marker, not in, in terms of the shifting politics of the movement, besides the sort of organizational debates within the community. There's also this kind of external shift that changes what the issues that the movement focuses on are about, so that police raids are no longer a kind of central issue.
Okay, we have, let's say 15 minutes or so. If you have questions that you'd like to address to any panelists, or not. Anybody? Questions, comments? Yes. Do you want me to, maybe I can do this and allow you to be heard. Can you do it? You would need to be there. All right. I'll change, I have a different role.
Will the book be for sale later, and how much is it?
That's a very good question. The book, yes, the book is for sale. It's going to be sold back here. Any one of us, I hope, will be willing to sign our piece in the book. And let's see, we have like, I think we have a special deal such that the usual subscription is $25. But if you subscribe to them, if you're not already a subscriber, you can subscribe and get the book for free. So the book retails for $20, but we'll sell the book alone for $15. So we have a lot available if you would like to buy a book, or if you'd like to subscribe. Because I couldn't help but notice that the vast majority of you had heard of the book, but not all of you are subscribers to the, I've heard of the magazine, I should say, but not all of you are subscribers, so this is your opportunity to subscribe and get the book for free. Other questions? Thank you so much for asking, because that was something I wanted to mention. Make sure everybody knows that the book is available, and we will sign copies for you after this is over. Any other questions? Yes, Chuck. I know your name, actually.
Thank you very much, and really great presentations from all the panelists. And I was wondering if you could maybe each speak, or anyone who are interested, in this idea that, I mean, there's always periods of like forward progress, but also pushback, right? I mean, these things sort of go in cycles. We're in a kind of a very interesting position right now politically, right, where things could go seriously in the opposite direction for progress in the next few years with the Supreme Court and other changes that have happened. Based on your different sort of engagements with history of LGBTQ organizing, what do you think are the most effective strategies that could be sort of started in the present that might be effective in the future?
Thoughts, anyone? Wow, you mean like new strategies that haven't been tried before? I think we've tried pretty much everything, but Michael Kennedy.
I mean, I continue to believe that the basic strategy is to elect as many gay, lesbian, bisexual, whatever, people as we can to every office, from, you know, senator to sheriff. I mean, it's one thing to have allies, you know, liberal people, et cetera, but it's a much better thing to have your own people in office. Politically, I haven't changed, Jesus, in 50 years. I still think that's what's important.
I think, you know, we've gone through periods of great backlash, and to some degree, I believe, I agree with Michael, but I actually don't. You know, in the last election, I decided that might be a good strategy, and I went with LPAC, which is the lesbian PAC, and gave money to a number of candidates. And one of them was Sinema in Arizona. I was a bisexual woman. As soon as she got in, she voted for Barr, and she voted for, and she's a Democrat, and she voted for all of these anti-LGBT judges who are now in for life as a Democrat, being backed by the LGBT community. So it really to me is, you know, I agree that we need allies, but to me it's more important that we have allies. I think what we, you know, for me, what I think is important is to go back to this idea that the Gay Liberation Front had. I mean, there are several ideas. One is that we have to go back to this idea of intersectionality. You know, we've forgotten that, you know, that we've forgotten that we need to work for things like choice for women, and that the, when women lose the right to control our bodies, we as women, that you are not going to expect, if you're a gay man or a trans person, you're not going to have control over your body either. These are not separate issues. Sexism and heterosexism are really the same issue. And I think that the way that our movement has gone into being a single issue movement, first of all, I think that to me is pretty deplorable. And that's one of the things that has left us out there as being very vulnerable. You know, we've isolated ourselves. And we became a single issue movement. Right after marriage equality was passed, the Empire State Agenda folded within months. Why? Because it was a one issue organization. All it was working for now was marriage equality. So when we had marriage, we had no rights organization in New York State. So my second point, and I always have many more points, but I'm going to stick to two. My second point is, in the early days, we didn't fight for legalization. We want decriminalization. And there's a big difference. When they legalize, like with abortion, they say, okay, abortion's legal, but now you can't have abortion in 20 weeks. Now you can't have it for 6 weeks. Soon it's going to be 4 weeks. Soon it's going to be when the egg and the sperm are in the same room, you can just forget it, right? With decriminalization, there are no laws that regulate your body. And that's what we wanted in 1969. We didn't want to legalize homosexuality. We didn't want them to say, well, you could do this with your penis, you could do this with your vagina, I hope everybody's 18. We wanted them not to tell us anything that we could do. And when we started working to legalize this and that, we left out the people who fell outside those boundaries. And I think for me, that's what we need to go back to, is decriminalization. Because we need to get the state and the government and the city government, state and federal, just get them off our backs completely and take a different path here, rather than chipping away and say, okay, we'll get this right, we'll get that right. I think we need to go for a different path. But that's, you know, that's just me. And I've been, you know, going for 50 years at this with that path. Okay.
We have time. I think there was another question over here next to Chuck.
Sure. Well, it's really more like a comment on this two-part community everybody's describing. The two things that made it possible for me to come out were the anti-war movement and the hippie counterculture. And Amy's here from Gay Community News. When I was there, those were all sort of the same thing, you know? And in fact, I went to my 50th college reunion last week and somebody said to me, oh, well, we all knew you were gay because you wore flamboyant hippie clothing. So the thing that I got from the hippie movement was this sort of freedom to express whoever you happen to be. And from the anti-war movement, I got the message that the government isn't always right, and sometimes you have to tell them that you don't agree with them. So then I could come out, right? But it always saddens me when we have this ongoing battle between the people who say we have to work on gay things and the people who say we have to work on everything, as if they were in competition or something. They may be in competition for individual members, but they're not in competition in terms of their goals. We both want, both sides want everything, right? I mean, for me, arguing for gay liberation in the 1970s was arguing for the freedom to wear whatever you wanted and express yourself however you wanted. It was, that was part of the gay thing. And so I just feel really sad when we end up with two parades, because I don't understand why we couldn't all be together. And that would be a way of injecting the intersectional viewpoint into the quote unquote mainstream gay world. But we always seem to split apart rather than look for what we have in common.
Maybe there's a practical reason for that. Just imagine how long the parade would be if there was just one parade that had everybody. So you know, man, maybe it makes sense. So two parades, and it won't take, maybe it'll only take 8 hours for the long one to get done instead of 12. It was 9 hours last year. So imagine what it's going to be, 9 hours, wow. Question over here.
Around a while, but I'm just curious, what do you think is the true significance of Marsha and Sylvia in the Stonewall Uprising? Because I understand from David Carter and Eric Marcus, they weren't there, at least on the first night. And subsequently over, I mean, I don't know how many years, a couple of decades before they both died, I mean, what was their real significance in our movement? I think it's also like this thing is rewriting. I think their significance has grown. And I mean, I was around when they were around. I don't remember much, but can anyone answer?
I have no view on this matter. Carla?
Both Marsha and Sylvia were in the Gay Liberation Front, and STAR was originally a cell within the Gay Liberation Front. And in the fall of 1970, when we had a sit-in in the subcellar of Weinstein Hall, which was a dormitory at NYU. Sylvia, who was mostly there, we had this crazy idea. We went down to Weinstein Hall, and on the way, we picked up homeless trans people. We said, come on, we got this nice warm place for you to come hang out for a few days. Nobody said we weren't crazy. And Sylvia saw this need for people to have a place. Marsha wasn't there that much. And when we came out of that subcellar, and the police were waiting for us with guns, but when we came out of there, Sylvia did form STAR with Marsha, and they did set up a place in the East Village. And, you know, Sylvia, they were very different people. And I want to say that one of the things that has been forgotten is we had really many trans women in the Gay Liberation Front. We had many of the pictures that are attributed to being of Marsha are actually of a woman named Zazu Nova. And people say, oh, there's Marsha, but it's not, it's Nova. It's like you've seen one black trans woman, you've seen them all. It's just really awful. But there was Bubbles and Alicia. There were a lot, and there were women who probably would be trans men today. But the significance, you know, is they did a lot of amazing work, and it really, you know, can't be dismissed. And I think that I probably separate from a lot of my sister lesbians in thinking that everyone should have some statue that you can look at and you can see someone in New York City who represents you. Unfortunately for women, if you go to Central Park, the only woman is Mother Goose. And I think we have to have more statues of women also, let me tell you, because Mother Goose and I really don't have a lot in common. So although there is Eleanor Roosevelt and there's Joan of Arc, who may be trans, she may have been a lesbian. I'm not going to go in there. Jim Cecil is back there and knows more about that period. Joan of Arc and I never dated. But, they're really important. Whether or not they were at Stonewall, I was not there with a roll book. I was a teacher. I didn't take attendance. That's really hard to get into. And we all have different views of what happened even 50 years ago. And I know that's very contentious. I was not there the first night. I don't know. I cannot answer that.
Any other questions?
On the relationship these days between the larger gay movement and the trans community. I'm not sure where we all stand, whether we're together or separate. Occasionally, it feels as though we're competing somehow. There's not enough air for the both of us, it seems like. But I'm interested what the panel would have to say.
There are many sort of traditional lesbians, especially in the UK, and I have no idea why, for some reason, this movement, so-called TERP movement, have you heard about that? Which is the TERP, I forget, don't even ask me to remember what all the letters stand for, but they are traditional lesbians who believe that transgender women are not really women, that you have to be born a woman, and that you also have to be raised. The experience of being raised a woman is also important. So you can't just, their position, I'm not expressing this obviously myself, is that you can't just suddenly sort of pop up and say, oh, okay, I'm a woman. Irrespective of your anatomy, it's a question of your socialization, and also they do get into the question of anatomy. It's a messy question and probably one that even talking about is going to get me into hot water. So I would just say that we have addressed it in the magazine, and I think in, maybe not this issue, but I think maybe in the last issue, there's actually a whole article about this and about the controversy and about the way in which there is in, especially the UK, but also in this country to some extent, real opposition on the part of traditional lesbians, as well as other feminists, so-called traditional feminists, against the transgender community, or at least against a certain kind of approach to transitioning that they find insufficient. Yes.
I want to say, I actually think there's more unity now, especially after Trump's election, between LGBT and trans activists than, for example, during all the years that Human Rights Campaign refused to even officially endorse transgender equality, right? Which, I felt last year's New York Pride to me felt incredibly, like the trans visibility, even, non-trans folks kind of identifying trans issues as the most pressing, urgent issue, I had never seen that. And so I think that the debate that you're talking about in the UK is important, but I feel like it's a very small, I don't want that to sort of stand in for queer politics as a whole.
No, neither do I. I think that's
very small, and those people are allied with the right wing in the United States. So I'm not sure that most feminists would even recognize them as allied with feminists. I think there's plenty of oxygen. One of the things that really gives me hope, in addition to what Tim was saying, is that I teach college students, and the students that I have met through my teaching are so many of them are queer identified, and that means something very different to each one of them if you talk to them in detail. Some of them identify as trans, some of them identify as lesbians or as gay men or as poly people. But I think that they all, that I teach creative writing. The students that I teach, even the ones who are straight identified, all write about queer issues in their work because it's something in the culture, it's part of the discourse. And that gives me great hope. When I taught 30 years ago, I could not even consider coming out to my college students. The whole bargain that I was the teacher and they were the students would not have continued. And now I told them, I'm grateful to you because I can be here as who I am. And also because their sort of natural inclination is so intersectional. So I want to feel like there's plenty of oxygen for all of us. I just wanted to mention that I brought a few copies of, Jim mentioned that I worked on Gay Community News. I brought some copies of the 10th anniversary issue of Gay Community News. And if you're interested, you're welcome to take one. No, it's the full issue. Yeah. It's Gay Community News was a weekly newspaper in Boston, 1979. So these are, it's photocopies of an old issue. 10th anniversary Stonewall. No, Gay Community News was founded in 1973. But we put out a 10th anniversary issue in 1979. Yes. No, it's the 10th anniversary of Stonewall. Sorry.
Stephen, I already did announce, actually, when you were gone. I announced the business about the book. I don't know if you want to repeat. Do you want to just, like...
Yes, I'm Richard Schneider's partner, Stephen Hemrick. And I just, on behalf of the Gay and Lesbian Review, want to thank the Historical Center for coming and make sure that if you haven't already checked out the exhibits that are here that have been mentioned, Letting Loose and Fighting Back, LGBTQ Nightlife Before and After Stonewall, By the Force of Our Presence, Highlights from the Lesbian Her Story Archives, and Say It Loud, Out Loud and Proud, 50 Years of Pride. But also want to express gratitude to Timothy, Michael, Amy, and Carla for participating on the panel. And most of all, thank you all for coming. And just to reiterate, because I'm not sure, the books will be sold over in that corner. Subscriptions will be sold over in that corner.
Oh.
And it's if you already have a subscription, you can use it to get a free book if you want to renew. It makes a nice gift. You can give a gift subscription. And it's only $25 to subscribe. The book is normally $20, $15 on sale tonight. Thank you again.
And then...